Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. Today, episode 138, The Battle of Thomas Creek. A few weeks ago, in episode 130, I provided some background on the ongoing disputes between the Loyalists in East Florida and the Patriots in Georgia. I ended that episode in February 1777 with the Loyalists having captured Fort McIntosh and leaving the border open to continuing raids by Loyalists and their Creek allies. Following the Patriot loss at Fort McIntosh, local morale fell. The 400-man force of Georgia militia dwindled to about 200. American General Robert Howe held command of the Southern Theater, but was up in Charleston, South Carolina. Robert Howe was no relation to British General William Howe. Robert was a North Carolinian and was spending most of his time fighting with South Carolinians over troop levels. South Carolina had recruited a bunch of North Carolina soldiers following the British attack on Charleston in early 1776. By 1777, North Carolina officials wanted their men back for the defense of their own state. General Howe was dealing with this fight and not giving much attention to the Georgia-Florida border fighting. With the desperate need for troops following the loss of Fort McIntosh, Howe managed to send about 150 Virginia recruits and about 160 from South Carolina to supplement the 200 Georgians still trying to defend the border. Georgia forces also had 5 or 6 small military vessels armed with cannons, as well as 16 military transports. The primary goal of these ships was to disrupt trade between East Florida and Britain's island colonies in the West Indies. At the same time, Georgia maintained its own trade with Charleston and Philadelphia, as well as several colonies in the French and Dutch West Indies. It even still covertly traded with British-controlled Bahamas, despite the trade bans. Fortunately for the Americans, the British forces in East Florida also remained dismally low. British Governor Patrick Tonin, a former British officer in the army himself, had been trying to cobble together a defense force for East Florida. His one regiment, the 14th, commanded by Colonel Augustine Prevost, received about 40 reinforcements, only to be quickly followed by an order from General William Howe to send about half of his regiment to New York. British General Howe ordered Colonel Prevost to keep East Florida on the defensive and make no attempt to engage in further raids into Georgia. Following the parole of American prisoners captured at Fort McIntosh, Governor Tonin expected the return of British prisoners in Georgia to be returned as part of the prisoner exchange, but Georgia did not have enough prisoners to exchange. The result of all of this was that East Florida's defenses relied on militia, primarily Loyalist refugees from Georgia. Colonel Thomas Burntfoot Brown commanded the militia. He had led the raid on Fort McIntosh and was eager to engage with the enemy. The remaining defenses came mostly from local tribes under the control of Seminole Chief Ahia, more commonly known to the British as Cowkeeper. Governor Tonin had also tried to get British Indian agent David Tate to provide warriors. But Tate was involved with the Creek Nation, which was further away from the conflict and showed much less interest in getting involved. Governor Tonin's naval support was also almost non-existent. It had dwindled down to one 14-gun ship, the Rebecca. This allowed Georgia's ships to intercept and capture a number of merchant ships trying to bring supplies to St. Augustine. To supplement the Rebecca, Tonin pressed into service 3 transport ships, the Meredith, the Triumvirate, and the Hawk, mounting 10 guns on each ship. Governor Tonin and Colonel Prevost also did not agree on a strategy. Prevost wanted to pull all forces back to St. Augustine, where they could fight a defensive battle from behind the city walls. Tonin wanted a more aggressive defense where forces would remain mobile and challenge the Americans for every inch of soil. Now, back in Savannah, the Georgia Patriot president, Button Gwinnett, was eager to invade East Florida and capture St. Augustine. Remember, Gwinnett had wanted to be named a Continental General. When Lachlan McIntosh beat him out for that job, Gwinnett had to settle for delegate to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. It was there that he signed the Declaration of Independence. But after a few months in Congress, Gwinnett returned to Georgia and was elected Speaker of the Assembly under the state's new constitution. In February, following the loss of Fort McIntosh, Georgia President Archibald Bullock requested and received near dictatorial power to deal with the emergency of a potential invasion. 2 days after receiving this power, he died under mysterious circumstances, leaving the controversial Gwinnett as the new dictator of Georgia. Gwinnett was eager to prove himself a leader who could bring military success. He requested that American General Robert Howe in Charleston send more Continentals to Georgia to assist with the invasion. But General Howe thought Georgia needed thousands of soldiers just to defend its border, soldiers he could not spare. At the same time, General Howe was already handling a fight between North and South Carolina, in which both complained that they did not have enough soldiers. He was also under orders to send most of his soldiers north to support General Washington's army in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. So with all these demands for soldiers, and facing only shortages, Howe was not about to deploy thousands of soldiers to attempt some crazy invasion of East Florida just because some governor thought it was a good idea. Despite not getting any soldiers, Governor Gwinnett remained undeterred. He and the Council of Safety proposed an invasion with the few hundred men that they had at their disposal. In these desperate times with limited forces and the desire for military victory, you might think Gwinnett would put aside his personal feud with General McIntosh and work together to make the best battle plan that they could. But no, Gwinnett instead had McIntosh's brother arrested on charges of treason about this time and tried to get General McIntosh removed from command. At first, Gwinnett tried to raise enough militia to invade without the assistance of any of the Continentals under McIntosh's command in Georgia. But by late March, he realized he was not going to get the forces that he needed. Gwinnett held a council of war with the Continental officers, but did not invite McIntosh to attend. Instead, Colonel Samuel Elbert would lead the Continental force. Now, General McIntosh, despite his personal issues, ordered his subordinates to cooperate with the governor if he requested their assistance. At the same time, though, he objected to a civilian stepping in to hold a council of war and not include the military commander, and also issue orders to his subordinates. But rather than fight this out by issuing contradictory orders, McIntosh went to Savannah. There, he would take up his complaint directly with the Council of Safety. The Georgia militia would also supplement the Continentals. Gwinnett managed to raise a little over 100 volunteers, commanded by Colonel John Baker. The plan was for the Continentals to move down the coast in transport ships while the militia traveled overland. The two groups would meet up at a place called Sawpit Bluff, about 50 miles north of St. Augustine. The two groups set off around May 1, 1777, planning to meet up again 12 days later. From the beginning, things did not go well. Colonel Baker's militia had trouble crossing rivers that were flooded thanks to spring rains. They barely made any progress into East Florida by May 4th, when a group of native warriors supporting the British attacked the militia camp. Two militia officers were wounded in the fight, and one Indian was killed. The warriors fled as the militia pursued them for about 12 miles. When they could not catch up, they gave up the chase and returned to camp. The angry militia mutilated the body of the dead Indian and left it for his friends to find. Despite these delays, the militia made it to Sawpit Bluff by the 12th and awaited the Continentals. Continental Colonel Elbert slowly made his way down the coast. He did not reach the north end of Amelia Island, about 15 miles north of the rendezvous point, until the 18th. Elbert dispatched a team of 20 soldiers, commanded by a Lieutenant Ward, to round up all the inhabitants of the island. Ward's detachment had orders to capture any cattle or pigs that they could find to make salt meat for the under-provisioned army. Beyond that, they were ordered to protect civilian property and treat all prisoners, especially women and children, with care. While Ward was rounding up his prisoners, a group of loyalist resistors took a few shots at the soldiers. Two soldiers were badly wounded, and Lieutenant Ward was shot dead. When Colonel Elbert got the news, he ordered his soldiers to burn every house on the island and destroy all other property that they could find. With the Continentals distracted on Amelia Island, Colonel Baker's militia sat around Sawpit Bluff wondering what happened to them. For a few days, the militia simply waited, not moving from the rendezvous point. Meanwhile, the British received word that an American invasion was underway. Loyalist militia Colonel Brown took a group of about 40 Rangers and Indians to make contact with the enemy. Late on May 14th, Brown's force sighted the enemy camp of the militia at Sawpit Bluff. Brown dispatched some of his Indians for a night raid with the goal of stealing the Patriot horses. The force made off with about 40 horses, although a sentinel did see the attackers and fire on them. The next morning, Baker's Patriot militia found their horses tied up near a swamp about 4 miles from their camp. Now, this was an old Indian trick. The horses were bait. When the soldiers tried to retrieve them, they would walk into an ambush. Baker was aware of this and tried to avoid getting caught in a trap. He kept his main force in plain view to distract the Indians, while a small group snuck in to untie the horses. Once untied, a third group rushed in to drive the horses out in a hurry. The Indians chased after the men and horses, but gave up after a few miles. They then set the woods on fire to avoid being pursued as they withdrew. Several of the horses were killed in the incident. The Patriots also suffered 2 wounded. They managed to kill 1 or 2 Indians, which they again scalped and mutilated their bodies. The Indians returned to Brown's main force. Brown then moved his forces to meet with a larger contingent, including British regulars. Colonel Baker realized that things were going bad for his Patriot militia. There was still no word from Colonel Elbert and the Continentals. The British now knew where Baker and his militia were camped and were no doubt planning another attack. Rather than wait for the attack to come, Baker started to retreat north and further inland, following the creeks to find a place to ford and move back toward Georgia. On May 16th, Baker's Patriot militia made camp along Thomas Creek. He was not aware that Colonel Brown's British militia and Indian force had met up with Colonel Prescott's larger force of regulars, which now totaled between 200 and 250 regulars, loyalist militia, and Indians. Brown and Prescott put together a plan, which they executed the following morning. As expected, Baker's Patriot militia broke camp early and continued their retreat following Thomas Creek upstream. Around 9 a.m., they ran into an ambush led by Brown. The Americans got within 50 yards before the enemy rose up and fired a devastating volley into their lines. The startled Patriots turned and fled, only to run into Prevost's 100 regulars marching up behind them. To add to the wild chaos, Indian warriors began jumping out of the sides of the road to attack anyone who came too close. The Patriot militia panicked and fled into the swamps. During the confusion, someone took Colonel Baker's horse and he had to flee on foot. It was a total rout. The fighting lasted only about 5 minutes. 3 Americans were killed and 9 wounded. Between 30 and 40 were taken prisoner. The rest, who had scattered into the swamps, evaded their pursuers. Several of the wounded who fled died in the swamps over the next few days. The British reported no casualties. Now, the Indians were angry at the Patriots, who had scalped and mutilated the bodies of their fellow warriors at the encounters a few days earlier. After the fighting ended, the Indians killed between 15 and 24 of the prisoners. Again, accounts differ, leaving only 15 surviving prisoners. This event is sometimes called the Thomas Creek Massacre. The scattered militia mostly made their way back to Georgia, across the Satilla River, and back into Patriot lines. A few of them made their way to Amelia Island, where they met up with Elbert and the Continentals. The British forces, who had marched hard through several days of heat, were too tired to pursue them and allowed them to escape. As the Continentals learned of the defeat at Thomas Creek, Elbert had to decide what to do next. As his men waited, two of British Governor Tonon's warships, the Rebecca and the Hawk, encountered the 16-gun American ship supporting the Continentals on May 25th. The British almost took the ship when a well-placed shot took out the Rebecca's topmast. Both she and the Hawk, which had also sustained considerable damage, had to withdraw. Following this, Elbert attempted to move his fleet inland up a river toward the British force. They found that the flooded rivers had subsided and that they could not get their ships through the shallow water. After a week of trying, Elbert's forces were running out of food and facing more desertions. He pulled back his small fleet to Georgia, but also deployed a land force to march overland toward Georgia. Their mission was to destroy any farms and drive off any cattle so that the enemy could not benefit from them. It was not until June 15th that the force finally returned to Savannah. So, at the same time this whole campaign was taking place, General McIntosh and President Gwinnett were battling with each other in Savannah. As I said, McIntosh had gone there to protest Gwinnett's interference with the army. There was supposed to be an election on May 8th to choose a new governor under Georgia's new constitution. The Council of Safety decided it would do nothing until after the elections. In those elections, Gwinnett lost to another political opponent, John Adam Troitland. The wide margin indicated that the voters were unhappy with the way he was running things. Troitland, a self-made man who had arrived in the colony as an indentured servant, took office immediately after the election. With the election over, the new assembly took up McIntosh's complaint. The two sides argued about who did what and blamed the other for the delay in the expedition and its ultimate failure. At one point, McIntosh called Gwinnett a scoundrel and a lying rascal. In the end, the assembly decided that civilian control of the military was of paramount concern, and that Gwinnett was within his authority as president at the time. Although Gwinnett won that political battle, he was out of office and bitter at the turn of events. On the evening of May 15th, Gwinnett sent McIntosh a note saying that he knew McIntosh had called him a scoundrel and that he demanded satisfaction. In other words, a duel. McIntosh agreed to pistols at dawn the following morning. Both men showed up in the morning at the appointed time and place. They stepped off their distance, aimed their weapons, and both fired at the same time. Both men were hit in the leg and fell to the ground. They debated a second round of firing. However, their seconds insisted that both had acted honorably. The men shook hands and left to get medical attention. McIntosh recovered from his leg wound. Gwinnett, however, suffered for 3 days before dying from his wound. Thus, he became the first signer of the Declaration of Independence to die, less than a year after signing, and at the hand of a fellow patriot. Dueling, of course, was not legal even then, and McIntosh was charged with murder. He went to trial and was acquitted. I haven't seen the transcripts of the trial, but the typical defense against murder while dueling was that it was self-defense. The other party was shooting at me, and I shot back. Because dueling was socially acceptable at the time, the defense usually worked. After McIntosh's acquittal, he still feared that Gwinnett's friends would do something to take revenge against McIntosh. General Washington transferred him up north to get away from Georgia. McIntosh would spend the next winter at Valley Forge. McIntosh's brother, who had been forced to resign under Gwinnett's harassment, even ended up becoming a loyalist and joining the enemy militia as a captain. Following Gwinnett's death and McIntosh's removal from the state, the feud between the factions supporting either Gwinnett or McIntosh still continued for years, even after the war had ended. Beyond the personal, the two factions argued over civilian or military control of the Continental forces in the state. The squabbling between civilian authorities and the military in East Florida did not reach the level of pistols at dawn like it did in Georgia, but still it was not good. In April, British General William Howe had granted Augustine Provost the temporary rank of general while serving in America. Governor Tonon and General Provost, however, could not agree on who to credit with the victory at Thomas Creek. Provost gave most of the credit to the regulars, while Tonon credited the militia and Indians. Tonon also requested that Prevost pay some of the mission expenses for the Indians out of military funds, something Prevost refused to do. Tonon also had to foot the bill for the militia, something he also resented. Prevost wanted input on training and drilling in the militia regiments, but Tonon countered that if Prevost wasn't going to pay for them, he wasn't going to get input on how they should be maintained. At least the Navy recognized the vulnerability of East Florida. Admiral Richard Howe deployed three frigates to St. Augustine. This freed up Governor Tonon to return the ships that he had commandeered during the emergency. So, for all the fuss, the invasion of Florida led to no real change. The two sides still controlled the same territory. The border fighting entered a lull of minor raids on cattle. Not much would change for the next year. In both Georgia and Florida, leaders spent more time fighting with each other than with the enemy. Next week, we'll once again be moving north as Colonel Meigs leads a Patriot militia raid on Sag Harbor in Long Island, New York. Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show. I wanted to note that I made a few changes to my Patreon levels. My Minuteman level was changed from $4 to $5. If you're already paying at the $4 level, you can stay right there if you wish. There's no need for you to make any change. But for anyone joining at the new level, the cost is going to be $5. The benefits of commercial-free feeds, early access to episodes, and a look at my roadmap for the show all remain the same. I've also added a new $100 level called the Alexander Hamilton Club. Several people have expressed interest in becoming high-level sponsors of the podcast, and who am I to say no? I thought it was appropriate that Alexander Hamilton replaced Robert Morris as the highest level, since Hamilton took over the finances of the new United States after Morris retired from that role under the Articles of Confederation. Hamilton helped establish the new nation's financial system and made the U.S. economy run. Anyone who joins at the Hamilton level will certainly help this podcast run. If anyone opts to join at the Hamilton level, you will get a shout-out each week and an annual thank you gift for your generous support. Also, if anyone is interested in advertising on the show, I now have dynamic ad insertion available. This means you can put an ad on all my back episodes for a limited time in order to advertise your event. If anyone is interested, please email me, mtroy.history@gmail.com. That address is posted on my website, www.amrevpodcast.com. Okay. That's enough of my desperate and crass begging for money. Before I get to today's show, I want to issue a quick correction. A few weeks ago, I pronounced the last name of Benjamin Franklin's grandson, spelled B-A-C-H-E, as Backe. I've been trying to look up name pronunciations to avoid mistakes like this, but I've been pronouncing the name like that in my head for so many years that it didn't even occur to me to question it. I've heard quite a few varied pronunciations, but I think the correct one is Bache, Benjamin Franklin Bache. So sorry for any confusion there. In this week's episode, we return to the South, where the ever-hopeful Patriots attempted to expand their power and push the British out of Florida. As with the push northward into Canada, this push into Florida was also rebuffed. But of course, that was all on a much smaller scale. Both the British leadership in Florida and the American leadership in Georgia seem more at odds with each other than focusing on defeating the enemy. I also talked about the duel between Button Gwinnett and Lackland McIntosh. Of course, Button Gwinnett's death in that duel is quite controversial. Now, some have argued that Gwinnett was a schemer and had it coming. Others argued that he was simply being a politically correct patriot. And of course, like anyone who is PC, he would have to hate McIntoshes. But seriously, it is rather ironic that the first signer of the Declaration to die lost his life at the hands of a Continental general, not the enemy. McIntosh would serve up north for the next few years before returning south under General Lincoln. Unfortunately, McIntosh would be taken prisoner and out of the war for the year where the war raged most heavily in the South. After the war, McIntosh fell into relative poverty and did not do much in the establishment of the new nation. Even so, McIntosh's role in the war is a really interesting one and one that is not widely known. If you want to read more about McIntosh, my book recommendation this week is Lackland McIntosh and the Politics of Revolutionary Georgia by Harvey H. Jackson III. It's a relatively short book at just over 200 pages and was originally published in 1979 as a hardcover. Now, that hardcover version is virtually impossible to find these days, but there is a paperback reprint from 2003 that is much more available. Now, this was Dr. Jackson's first book. He has since written many more about early Alabama and Georgia history, and he is still a professor, I believe, at Jackson State University in Alabama. For my online recommendation this week, I'm going with something that, well, I guess is rather silly. A couple of years ago, Stephen Colbert had Lin-Manuel Miranda on his show, Late Night. As part of that episode, the two men perform a rap song for Colbert's new musical about Button Gwinnett, making fun of the fact that he is a virtually unknown founding father. I got a laugh out of it anyway. If you want to check it out, it is on YouTube. You can do a search for Stephen Colbert Button Gwinnett, or I've included a direct link to the clip on my website at www.amrevpodcast.com. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.